Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The skies over New York City lit up with fireworks last night to celebrate the state's lifting of coronavirus restrictions. And across the country, here in Los Angeles, more than 50,000 people filled Dodger Stadium for the first opening with full capacity. But as people celebrate the progress we've made in fighting COVID-19, the disease continues to claim lives. More than 600,000 people have died in our country from COVID-19. That's more than the population of Baltimore. So what do we still need to know and do as we work our way out of this pandemic? Well, let's bring in Dr. Krutika Kupali. She's an infectious disease expert at the Medical University of South Carolina. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Doctor, are you worried that we may be moving too fast and declaring victory over COVID-19?
You know, I am a little bit concerned that we might be moving a bit too fast. I think that one of the things that I've learned the last year and a half is that every step of the way, we get thrown curveballs when it comes to COVID-19. I think that we've been humbled by the virus and we've been humbled by these new variants that we keep learning about. And I do worry that we might be moving a bit too fast as we continue to learn about how these variants of concern are working. And also, you know, we're still learning about how various populations of people are responding to the vaccine. And so I think without having much more information about that, I get worried about us prematurely declaring victory, particularly when we're seeing what's happening around the rest of the world with cases surging, you know, not just in parts of Southeast Asia, but in Africa, in the UK, you know, all over the place.
Right. Well, about those variants, the CDC officially declared the Delta variant of the virus a variant of concern. What does that mean, and how concerned should Americans be about this variant?
Yeah, so a variant of concern is a variant where there's evidence of increase in transmissibility, we see more severe disease, and also a reduction in neutralization of antibodies that are generated during prior infection or vaccination. So it is concerning, and we've seen that. This Delta variant is the most contagious variant that we've seen thus far. We know that it spreads about 50 to 60% faster than any of the other variants that we've seen. So it's more contagious than the prior variant. And, you know, all one has to do is see what's happened in India and over in the UK to get an idea of how concerning it should be. Just in the United States so far, we've seen that it went from accounting for less than 3% of all infections to more than 6%, and may account for almost 10% of all infections. And there's concern it will become the dominant strain here. So, you know, that being said, the one thing that we do see is that the vaccines still work relatively well against this variant. So that's good. But we need to be worried about the people who are not fully vaccinated, those who've not been vaccinated. And again, we're still learning about how the vaccines work in people who may be immune compromised. So I think it could cause outbreaks in parts of the country where people haven't been vaccinated.
Let's talk a little bit more about those people who are most at risk. We know that the death rate has gone down dramatically since January, but there's still about 300 people who die from this disease on average every day. At this stage, who are the people? We know some immunocompromised, those who have not been vaccinated, but who are the people dying at relatively high rates? Who's at most risk right now?
Well, there was a study that came out recently from the CDC that people who are not getting vaccinated are mostly people in rural areas. Those are people who are less likely to have received the full course of the vaccine. So those are people we're most worried about. We are seeing younger people who are getting afflicted with disease because there's still that narrative out there that younger people can't get infected. And then also our racial and ethnic minorities, who there are still disparities when it comes to vaccination. So those are people we still really need to reach and We need to work with our healthcare providers, our pharmacies, our faith leaders and community partners to identify and address barriers to get people vaccinated.
There's still a lot that we're learning, and there's still a lot of things we need to keep in mind, safety precautions. I have just under 30 seconds with you. You know, we're not having the discussion anymore about masks and social distancing, but those are still very important steps to take, right, doctor? I only have 15 seconds.
Yes, absolutely. Those are very important steps to take, especially in areas where there has not been great uptake of the vaccine. And if you're immune compromised, especially, very important.
Dr. Krutika Kupali, infectious disease expert at the Medical University at South Carolina. I look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you.
Well, Presidents Biden and Putin have had their hugely anticipated first meeting in Geneva. They are holding separate news conferences. President Biden has yet to speak, but here's Russian President Putin speaking through an interpreter.
I think there was no hostility, quite the contrary. Our meeting took place principally speaking, many of our positions, we don't share the same positions in many areas, but I think that both of these sides showed a willingness to understand one another and to find ways to bring our positions closer together. The talks were quite constructive.
No hostilities, quite constructive. So what can we discern? NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow is here. Scott, it is very early days. But what is your initial reaction to what we've seen and heard in Geneva?
You know, I think we all know at this point in time that we need to hear both sides of the story before we can make any firm conclusions. And of course, we are waiting to hear from President Biden. But I think that headline right there and that clip right there shows that at least the very low bar that the White House had set for this meeting to have a conversation, to try and restore communications and get to a point of stability may have succeeded. There were a lot of questions of whether the fact that this meeting did not last quite as long as the White House said it might meant that things did not go well. But you're hearing Vladimir Putin right there saying, you know, as we heard, useful talks, no hostility. That was really the bar the White House was trying to meet, just to have conversations again, because really this relationship is at a post-Cold War low point.
Yeah. Well, it did go on for about 4 hours. Do we know anything about what was actually discussed?
We don't. I mean, Vladimir Putin is still speaking right now, mm-hmm. and he's being asked about issue by issue, so we're still trying to get a clear sense. I think we'll get a clear readout from the White House at one point. We do know that going into this meeting, the White House had a lengthy list of topics, everything from cybersecurity. Of course, the White House has pinned blame on recent high-profile ransomware attacks on criminals within Russia, not necessarily Russian state actors, but people inside Russia, to nuclear stability, to climate change, to, of course, Putin's annexation of Crimea in Ukraine, something the international community has opposed for years and really pushed back against. So a wide range of topics. But again, over and over, you heard the president and his advisors saying we're just beginning conversations. And the fact that Putin says there was an agreement for ambassador relationships to return seems to be a sign that it might have worked.
Yeah, they agreed to return ambassadors to each other's countries. Look, a lot of people would want President Biden's message to President Putin to be, don't do that, you know, when it comes to interfering in U.S. elections or these thought to be Russian-backed cyber attacks. Do we know what the pinpoint of the message that the U.S. wanted to get across was?
In terms of
the sharpest message they want to get across. Yeah.
I mean, I think you've heard it for months now from Biden. You heard it during the transition when that solar winds hack kind of escalated things even further. And you saw it when Biden imposed a wide range of sanctions on Russia, really going after Russia's ability to even borrow money from U.S. markets, that the U.S. is not going to allow this to keep happening. They are going to retaliate. But one of the biggest questions from national security experts is in this realm of cyber attacks and hacking, there are really no set protocols yet for deterrence like you have for physical attacks on each other. That's something the international community needs to sort out. And maybe because those conversations began, Putin indicated that there are going to be further talks on cyber. But right now, certainly a lot of cyber attacks are happening from Russia toward the U.S., and it's not clear if U.S. sanctions are going to stop them.
So we're hearing from President Putin now, President Biden, obviously waiting in the wings. This decision to not hold a joint press conference, we're wondering, do you think It's because the memory of President Trump standing next to President Putin in Helsinki in 2018 and then siding with him when Trump said he didn't think there'd be any reason that Putin would have to interfere with the U.S. election. Do you think that played into this decision not to be side by side?
Yeah, I think that was a big part of it, certainly. And President Biden also said this week that he said, look, the point is to have substantive conversations. I don't want this to turn into like a statecraft competition of one-upping each other and kind of attacking each other at the same time. I think that was a big part of it. But yeah, I mean, what do we remember from Helsinki, the two men standing next to each other? I don't think the Biden White House wanted to recreate that image.
Yeah, and we got 30 seconds. Biden's coming home to face some challenges.
He is. A lot of his transportation, his infrastructure agenda is stalled. He's got to make some choices on how to proceed on that. It's going to be the top topic when he lands in D.C.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When Ursula Burns was named the CEO of Xerox in 2009, her promotion was hailed as a groundbreaking achievement. Burns was the first Black woman to head a Fortune 500 company. She took over Xerox at a critical time when the country was just coming out of the 2008 recession. And as Burns writes in her new memoir, she began as an intern, over three decades worked her way up, and along the way was fortified by the wisdom of her mother and other mentors. Ursula Burns' new book is called Where You Are Is Not Who You Are, and she joins us via Skype. Welcome.
I am so pleased to be here.
Pleased to have you. And I want to ask you first about the title, Where You Are Is Not Who You Are. It was something your mother used to tell you. What does that phrase mean to you?
Right. My mother, you know, essentially we were the typical come from nothing family. My mother was a first generation immigrant, single parent. She was a welfare recipient. And when we were growing up, she would say to me always, this place that we live in, that is run down and dirty, this neighborhood that we live in that is disordered and not cared for, is not who you are. Who you are the people you surround yourself with. Who you are is the values that you have. So don't look at this place and think that that's who you are. And she said, remember that when you're rich and famous. Just imagine how like spiritually connected she was to my life as I went on without even knowing it.
Your mom never made more than $4,400 a year. This is the reality for millions of Americans, even to this day. And I bring this up because we often talk about overcoming poverty, but never really the lessons and the grit that comes with that kind of life experience, the tricks at life that people without means employ to survive. So in many ways, what you learned growing up could be seen as an advantage in your corporate career. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I so love that you picked that up because I was taught in college all of the things that college teaches you, just like every other white guy or doesn't matter what ethnicity that was in the room with me or a female, etc. The thing that I brought to that room that they didn't have that I had was this thing that's called grit, this confidence in myself that I could be better if I put energy forward and if other people supported me. This sense that you get when you're different and you have little is something that America actually, if you think about it, stands for. The whole story is you come here with nothing and you build up. So I think it was really important to how I made it through Xerox and up through Xerox and all of my experiences, even my work and boards, everything. I approach it from, you know, from where I was.
Can we talk a little bit about exceptionalism for a moment? You studied mechanical engineering, and you write that in college you were often treated as extraordinary because you were a Black woman who excelled in science. Were you ever bothered by being looked at or treated as a unicorn?
Absolutely. People were saying to me things, even as I became CEO, even to this day, you are amazing. You are extraordinary. You are... And I realized that they were saying that more for themselves than for me. And here's my thesis. In order for me to sit in the room with them, which I did regularly, in many different rooms, right? Sit in the room with the President of the United States, sit in the room with them in business meetings, right? In negotiations, in whatever. That in order for them to feel comfortable with me being there and every other person who looks like me not being there. They had to label me something other than just a regular old black woman. And I started to realize that this was more to justify the small numbers. You know, that may be a very negative approach to the compliment, but I don't feel it as the compliment. I don't see myself as being exceptional in any way, Tanya, in any way.
Well, with that, though, how do you reconcile that? Because at one time, in 2014, Forbes, I think, called you one of the most powerful women in the world. So after climbing for 30 years and you're at this top spot and folks have been telling you you're great, you're wonderful all of this time, and they're right because you have more than 30 years experience. How do you reconcile then as the one who has the power, who's calling the shots, to then in part maybe a change in culture?
What will break down this barrier more and more is more and more. More and more people who look less and less like them. And by the way, them I love. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I love white men. I love white women. I mean, this is not this thing like I want to keep you over. It's just that this is such an exclusive club of wealth and power and influence. It's a very, very exclusive club. And that club has to be integrated aggressively. We have to actually improve education throughout the nation, including in the neighborhoods that are not really rich. We have to improve healthcare. We have to improve opportunity to people who enter companies. We have to improve funding of startups. You name it. We have to equalize this more so that we can actually start to see, quote unquote, more exceptional people like Ursula Burns, end quote. Because I think if you do that, you will find that there are so many more people. You say, oh my God, this is not that exceptional. There were, you know, she's, don't get me wrong, she's good, she works hard, she can carry on a sentence, she can do integral math, she can lead a company, but there are a lot more people than just her that can do that.
Let's talk about your role at Xerox. 2009 is when you took over this top spot. You had the task of bringing Xerox into the future. What were some of the more challenging aspects to that mission of bringing this behemoth of a company into its future self?
Part of the challenge was fundamentally that when you are a behemoth, change is really, really hard. We were unbelievably excellent direct salespeople. We were unbelievably excellent makers of substantial machines that could last years. You know, all of the things about Xerox that were amazing were under attack, not by necessarily competition, but by advancements in technology, period. And we had to figure out a way to feel very comfortable with throwing a lot of these things that we loved away.
That sounds hard.
It is very, very hard because we had one unbelievably difficult variable in our business to predict, and that was humans. Businesses are about people. They're about people inside the company, and they're about customers and businesses who are made up of people outside the company. And to get this all to align well and to change easily, it's not like a program. You have to get a large number of people to align around the vision that you lay out, and you have to get them to start marching at least in the same direction and then hopefully in the same direction at the same pace. That's one reason why it was very difficult. The other one is that, you know, we're dealing in a time where there's nothing that's a secret anymore. And you can actually get a following in social media or whatever the heck it is. And it basically exposes another flank for you that you have to kind of respond to as well.
You know, through this pandemic, the challenges of parenthood and working has been laid bare. Leaders can see really under the hood, so to speak, of all of the extra work that parents, especially mothers, are doing at home and at work. And I was intrigued by the challenges you write about in your book that you experienced in managing your home life and your work life as the CEO of this Fortune 500 company. With that power, what insights did you learn on how we can support parents with demanding work?
We have to make sure that we have support infrastructure for them in business. Government and business has to help. So healthcare has to be reasonable and affordable, even if you have three children. It can't be... access to childcare. We have to figure out a way to have a better partnership between businesses and childcare provision and governments to actually assure that parenting is not this like horrible thing that we have to just kind of figure our way around. And then clearly, career progression, pay, all the basic infrastructures of work cannot suffer because one gender has to actually physically carry the child and therefore in the younger part of their life are more naturally aligned to take care of the child. This can't be a negative. It actually has to be at worst neutral, at best a positive.
Ursula, you said at the start of your book that you didn't feel like your life was interesting enough to fill the pages. I'm sorry, I have to chuckle at that. And yet you did. You filled all of the pages. What did you learn about yourself in the process of writing this book? And maybe what do you want people to take away from your book?
What I learned and what I want people to learn in this book is it doesn't take silver spoons always. It doesn't take tons of money. If we do little bits ourselves, we can actually transform not only our neighborhoods, but with that, we can transform our cities and then our states and then this country and then the world. I always push against this zero-sum game theory that we are playing right now, that I can only make it if I take it from you. It's so untrue. My life is proof that that's not the case. I have a lot, and I am willing to have people have joy and comfort because it's fun. It's worth it. The city is fun. The world is fun. If we just can lift up people a little bit every day, it's not that hard. I mean, it is hard, obviously, Tanya, but it's not, you know, this is not impossible to do.
At the same time, it's simple.
Yes, at the same time, it's simple.
Ursula Burns' memoir is Where You Are Is Not Who You Are. Ursula, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
And to read an excerpt of Ursula Burns' book, go to hereandnow.org.
An internal investigation found that a cop with the California Highway Patrol sexually harassed 21 women. But those findings were kept secret until a new state transparency law passed. We dug through hours of tapes to find out what happens to officers who cross the line. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
We've spoken here before with people whose loved ones died because they were diabetic and rationing their insulin when it got too expensive. There have been protests outside big pharma offices over the rising cost of this life-saving drug. And last week, Mississippi Attorney General Lynn Fitch announced a first-of-its-kind lawsuit against drug makers and pharmaceutical executives alleging a widespread conspiracy to inflate the price of insulin to win placement on formularies. Those are the lists of medicines for which insurance is provided. Let's get a quick primer from Ed Silverman with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine Publication. And Ed, there was another lawsuit filed by a county in Texas. This is the first forcing drug makers and pharmacy benefit managers to defend themselves together. So what is a pharmacy benefit manager and how does that fit in this?
So the pharmacy benefit manager will negotiate with the drug manufacturer for that formulary placement. In that gatekeeping role, they hold a lot of power, a lot of decision-making that affects every single person covered by whichever health plans they contract with.
Wow. So is there, you know, we hear the word rebate thrown around. How does that fit in?
Well, to get the best placement possible on a formulary, the drug manufacturers will pay rebates, sometimes called discounts, but rebates to the pharmacy benefit managers for that favored placement. And we know there are three big insulin makers in this country, so they're competing for formulary placement. And again, to get the best placement, they'll pay a rebate to the PBM. The PBMs, in turn, say that they pass on those rebates, or almost all of them, minus a small fee. They'll pass on almost everything to the health plans. Meanwhile, the rebate goes up each year because the competition is continually very intense.
Well, Mississippi's Attorney General Lynn Fitch says that the price of insulin has gone up over 1,000% in the last decade. I'm presuming it's because of this inching up system of rebates that you talk about. How are manufacturers and the pharmaceutical companies defending this relationship they have?
Well, the manufacturers, the drug makers say they have to keep raising their wholesale or list prices each year to cover the increased rebates each year. And in fact, some drug makers have now released annual reports showing how, in general, the rebates are eating into their revenues more and more. So their net prices are falling. But for consumers who pay at the pharmacy counter and don't have insurance, they're paying more because the way our system works, their price at the pharmacy counter, their out-of-pocket cost, is tied directly to the list price. So if the list price goes up to cover higher rebates that are paid to PBMs, the uninsured pay more out-of-pocket. And for those who are insured, they're still paying more because the health plans are comparably increasing their prices.
Boy, we'll have you back again as this plays out now, possibly in a courtroom. Ed Silverman with STAT on the first-of-its-kind state, Mississippi, suing drug makers and pharmaceutical benefit managers over their relationship in the production of insulin. We'll follow this. Ed, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Southern Baptist Convention, the country's largest Protestant organization, was born of division. It split with Northern Baptists in the 1800s over slavery. Well, this week, thousands of convention churches sent representatives, called messengers, to the group's annual meeting in Nashville, still divided over race, and now charges of concealing sexual abuse. Yesterday, in a close surprise result, the Southern Baptists voted in Alabama pastor Ed Litton, known for his work on racial reconciliation, as their new president. Nashville Public Radio's Blake Farmer has been following this. And Blake, just briefly, recently hugely popular evangelist Beth Moore quit. She cut ties with the church. She'd been critical of Donald Trump's treatment of women. She felt the church wasn't. She left. This has been a tense time.
Yeah, that's just one example. Tense for sure. And you can feel it at times with these 14,000 messengers all packed in a fairly stuffy convention hall as they're voting on these divisive position statements. A proposal condemning critical race theory is introduced. Half the room cheers. It fails. The other half cheers. I mean, you really just get a sense that the political divisions playing out in America are doing the very same in its largest Christian denomination.
Right. Critical race theory. Backers say it's a way of understanding how racism shaped this country. Those against it say it unfairly blames whites for old history. Litton, the new president, said it was a distraction and racial injustice is all around us. Let's listen.
I think a movement could be started very simply if we would encourage our people to get out of the bubble and to actually look around, begin to ask God to open their eyes.
So, Blake, it seems like his win is a loss for the ultra-conservatives. In this conservative organization, what does his stand on race bring to the Southern Baptist Convention?
Well, it's worth noting he was nominated by the only black pastor to ever serve as president of the Southern Baptist, Fred Luter, who called Litton a uniter who could help keep black pastors in the convention who've been wondering if they still have a place there. Litton has been quite active trying to help his church in Mobile, Alabama, navigate the fallout from the high-profile deaths of black men killed by police. And last night, he even talked about a smile campaign where members were put on a mission to just have friendly engagements with people who don't look like them. So, in big and small ways, this seems to be his central issue.
But he's going to be having to deal with these allegations of a cover-up of sexual abuse within the church. A Texas pastor released secret recordings last week attempting to back up that claim of a cover-up. People went to microphones, got very emotional. Tell us more about this.
Well, I mean, there's pretty widespread acknowledgement that, like many churches, Southern Baptist congregations have dealt with a fair share of staff members abusing women and kids. The current issue, though, circles around an internal debate about how publicly to acknowledge the cases and even possibly concealing some abuse. It's one of the main reasons Russell Moore, a name that may be more familiar outside Baptist circles, stepped down from his post as sort of the denomination's lead thinker, and that was last month. He'd put on conferences where where church abuse survivors were allowed to speak. And that caused some consternation from the ultra-conservative wing of the denomination. And in these secret recordings made by one of Russell Moore's allies, these more conservative leaders sound like they're more worried about upsetting what they call the base of the denomination than really trying to make amends.
Yeah, but a lot of exits from this Southern Baptist Convention, as with other Christian denominations. But briefly, will Lytton's victory maybe, you know, boost the membership?
Well, his victory does mean some black pastors will stay around, and that likely means their congregations will as well. They had threatened to leave if more conservative candidates had won. And Lytton does say he plans to tell pastors of color that the denomination really needs them, and for a number of reasons, but practically speaking, and most immediately, because their congregations are really the only ones that are growing right now.
Nashville Public Radio's Blake Farmer, thank you.
You're welcome.
About 3 weeks ago, journalist Daniel Fenster was preparing to board a flight from Myanmar back to his home state of Michigan when he was detained at the airport. Since then, his family has been desperately trying for answers on why he's being detained. Fenster is the managing editor of Frontier Myanmar, an independent news outlet. Since the military took control of the country through a coup in February, it has cracked down on opposition, arresting thousands and killing hundreds of people. Daniel Fenster's brother, Brian Fenster, joins us now. Brian, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. And off the top, we're just so grateful to have this platform. Thank you.
Well, thank you for being here, Brian, to share a bit about your brother. The White House has said the administration is deeply concerned about his detention. What more can you tell us about what happened to him at the airport?
Well, we don't have much information. From our understanding, he made it through security without issue. You're supposed to get approval to even travel 10 days out from your flight. He had that, proper visas, passports, everything. We were told that he was at his gate, and minutes before boarding, I guess he was pulled aside for questioning, and he was detained.
We've been hearing that it's believed that your brother was taken to a prison in Myanmar that is known for being notoriously brutal. Again, that is just information that we're hearing, but it's not confirmed. What other information do you have about him, how he's doing, where he's being held?
We're fairly certain, you're referring to Insane Prison, aptly named. Different spelling, of course, but we're fairly certain he's there. We have yet to hear from him or establish any kind of contact, and not for any lack of effort on our government's part. They've been absolutely wonderful, have requested access since day one, and have repeatedly requested access, not to mention his release, and this regime has yet to even reply to the request.
Right. Michigan U.S. Representative Andy Levin has been working with the State Department to get information and to get Daniel released. What more do you want to see the U.S. government do?
Well, we know that this is being worked on at the highest levels. The government has our full support. We have full confidence in them. But we really just want to, we need to create this sense of urgency. So we're looking for more public statements from our elected officials. We think that is going to go a long way in penetrating this regime that seems to be very insulated and not only receiving information, but they're incredibly slow to move the information. Danny has not done anything wrong. He was doing his job. His papers were legit. His employment was legit. Where he's working, Frontier Myanmar, is only one of a handful of independently run publications. They are operating on a working visa. There's no issue there. So we really want some answers. We want to make sure he's okay. We haven't talked to him.
How long has your brother been working in Myanmar?
Danny has been in Myanmar since May 3rd, 2019, which ironically was World Press Freedom Day. So he has been there just over 2 years.
Let's talk a little bit more about your brother's job. The Foreign Correspondents Club of Thailand has estimated that more than 70 journalists have been detained in Myanmar since February. Do you think that his work with this publication is why he is being detained?
We only have our assumptions, unfortunately. It may be. This is a country that wants to put a cloak over the truth. They don't want the world to know what is happening there. He is a journalist in a country where the government, in quotes, wants to control a narrative. This is somebody who was at a desk as an editor and making sure English translations were coherent and accurate. He was not inciting any violence. He was not on the ground at any protests. He was not using his personal voice to express opinion. He was reporting the news.
You and your family are basically working day in and day out to get answers and to try to find out what has happened to Daniel. Just this week, another American journalist who was being detained there was released, Nathan Mong. Does his release give you hope for Daniel's release soon?
Well, we were so happy to hear about Nathan, and we're just thrilled for him and his family. Cannot imagine what they have gone through. Yeah, it certainly gives us hope, but it's hard. You know, we're hopeful, but we're preparing for a long haul. We don't hope it doesn't come to that, because, again, we don't know what these people are thinking, what their protocol is, what their plan is. So we're cautiously optimistic, as we have been since day one.
Brian Fenster is the brother of American journalist Daniel Fenster, who's been detained in Myanmar. Brian, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate this.
Someday is finally here, and we're ready to sail beyond again without compromise.
That's an ad from Celebrity Cruises. In less than 2 weeks, they'll launch the first major cruise from a U.S. port in over a year. The company will require passengers 16 and older show proof that they've been vaccinated. But there's one hiccup. This requirement goes against a law in Florida. Back in April, the state's Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, signed an executive order that bans businesses from requiring proof of vaccination. Let's bring in Taylor Dolvin, who covers the tourism industry for the Miami Herald. She joins us now. And Taylor, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So what is the latest on this fight between the cruise industry there and the governor over these vaccination requirements?
It's difficult to call it a fight because it's really not playing out in public. You have the this first cruise company, Celebrity Cruises, that will be the first company to sail from a U.S. port, first major cruise company to sail from a U.S. port since March 2020, requiring vaccinations for its passengers on June 26th. And you have a state law passed earlier this year that bans Florida companies from requiring patrons be vaccinated. So these are really mixed messages for passengers. No one's exactly sure how this will play out. There seems mm-hmm. to be a workaround that the cruise company has come to, which is that they're going to ask everyone for proof. And if you can't provide proof or choose not to provide proof of vaccination, you will be considered unvaccinated and have to jump through other hurdles.
You know, this has to be resolved soon for the companies, because they face a $5,000 fine per passenger if they go against this law. I want to ask you about something else, though, Taylor. Two passengers tested positive for COVID-19. On the Celebrity Millennium cruise ship just last week. And that was the first cruise from a Caribbean port since November. What exactly happened there?
So this was the same company was doing a cruise, Celebrity Cruises, from St. Martin in the Caribbean. So the cruise was operating at about 30% capacity. And because the ship didn't leave from Florida, the company was able to require that everyone on board, besides a handful of children, were vaccinated. And so about 5 days into the cruise, two passengers who shared a cabin tested positive for COVID. So they were isolated, and they were they eventually disembarked in St. Martin and were flown home by the company on private transportation. And experts tell me, you know, this really shows that these vaccine requirements work. Because before the vaccine was available, this could have turned into a much larger and dangerous, deadly outbreak like the ones that we saw last year on cruise ships.
Oh, that's an interesting point to make. But public health experts in the Caribbean are also concerned about the prospect of unvaccinated Americans visiting. What are you hearing from them?
Yeah, there's a lot of caution, and Caribbean countries are really in a difficult position. They really depend on tourism for their economies and are really eager to get tourists back to spend money in their hotels, in their shore excursions, and the cruise industry is certainly a big part of that. The concern is that the vaccines are not yet widely available in Caribbean countries. Some still don't have robust testing capacity, and certainly their hospital and public health infrastructure is limited. And so if there were to be an outbreak from a cruise passenger, they would not be as well equipped to handle it as the U.S. would be at this point.
You know, as we know, the cruise industry has been at a standstill for well over a year. How badly does this season mean to getting things up and running and really for the viability of the industry?
Yeah, I don't think this is how cruise companies imagined the restart. All of this confusion over their ability to require vaccines for passengers in Florida has really put kind of a damper on the situation. But here in South Florida, you know, there are so many people whose jobs depend on this industry. I'm thinking of the longshoremen, for example, who load and unload cruise and cargo ships, who've seen their hours just really decimated over the last year. Mm. There's a shuttle drivers, you know, restaurant owners here who cater to cruise crew members. There's a lot of people who are really looking forward to this happening. I think everyone wishes it could be clearer.
Yes. Taylor Dolvin covers the tourism industry for the Miami Herald. As always, thank you so much, Taylor, for this update.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.